Eugene Stack?
Ahead, Eugene.
Sue, could you make a presentation now verbally about how your input to the platform will transform it for the better?
Sure, I can give a short talk. Okay. So, in the Constitution, the money privilege is to maintain the value of the money. That's part of it. Maintain the value of the money. So, in monetary reform, the value of the money is compared to the amount of goods and services that are circulating in the economy. That's how you maintain the value of money, right? So if we're going to produce more goods and services, we need more money, right? So that the value stays equal. In the 1930s, during the Great Depression, there was a farmer. He was a farmer. I think he was I forget what he did, corn or something. And he said to himself, wait a minute, he said, last month I got $3 for my bushel of corn. This month I'm getting $1.88. Wait a minute. My bushel of corn has the same nutrition in it. What's different? And that got him to reach out to people in his world of people to say, can you help me figure this out? So he got together around three or four people. One of them, I believe, was a Nobel Prize winner in statistics at the time. And this group did a deep dive into the national statistics on the economy that the government kept, the federal government. Now, they didn't have computers, so this was all done by hand. And they analyzed the data. And 3.5 years later, they came up with their conclusion. And this is the conclusion. If you an economy runs on the production of raw materials from the earth. That's where all of our wealth comes from. You don't have an industry, you don't have manufacturing unless you have raw materials. And I just, as an aside, I must say, when I was learning this, that came as a brand new idea to me. but it's the truth of our physical world. So, given that, all wealth comes from the earth, meaning the production of raw materials by the labor and the intellect of people learning to do that. If you give the producers of raw materials a price, this is a monetary issue, if you give them a price, at the first point of sale, they produced their wheat or their corn and they're selling it. If you give them a price in balance with the prices in the rest of the economy, then you will have an economy that works for everyone without the production of debt. And the reason is this. think of the this one farmer. He's producing his crop. He needs to buy a tractor. He needs to buy seed. He needs to go into his town and go to the hardware store and buy, I don't know, hammers or this or that or fencing, whatever. All of this stuff he needs, these are his expenses. He needs his earned income to pay for all of that. He's going to get that if he gets a fair price. Meaning, fair price, in my words, are he makes enough money from the sale of his crop at the first point of sale. He makes enough money he can pay off the tractor manufacturer, the hardware store in town, his labor, whatever, all of his expenses, and have some profit for him and his family. Okay. If that is true, according to these statistics that this group of men worked on, the economy can be fair to everybody in the economy. Because think of it, that money that the farmer has earned, he goes to pay the tractor owner. Okay, the tractor owner now has a fair price for his tractor. He doesn't have to reduce the price in order to get rid of tractors because the farmer has made enough money to pay him decently for that tractor. So that means the tractor manufacturer can pay for all of his expenses for his manufacturing plant, for his labor. Labor can get a decent price. And it goes around the whole economy. Okay, you could take it to the next step, but it goes through the whole economy. So the bottom line is, no one is getting screwed, cheated. That's the basic principle. And they proved it with the statistics. And the next piece of history that's very important, and there's other pieces of history, but these are the ones that stand out to me. So what Wilkins and these other men did, after they did all the deep dive in the statistics to prove this parity economy would be fair for everybody in the economy, they went to each of the states, and Wilkins did a lot of this. He was pretty incredible, motivated guy. And each state has a Secretary of Agriculture for it. And they went to the Secretary of Agriculture and they gave presentations explaining this system to them. So the next thing that, and that's like towards the end of the 30s. So the next thing that happens is the U.S., Japan bombs Pearl Harbor, December 1941. Suddenly, the Congress, the people in the Congress are scared shitless because we've been in a depression. What are we going to do? We now have this huge war. What are we going to do? So, what happened was, Wilkins and his, mostly Wilkins, but the secretaries of agriculture from the states went into Congress and they started teaching the congressmen this system, this, you know, based on these statistics. And in, I think it was the spring of 1942, because the bombing was December 1941, so somewhere around April of 1942, not very far, Wilkins had probably spent most of his time in committee meetings in Congress explaining all this. Congress passed a national bill about parity. And parity became the policy, the legal policy during the war up to 1950. And the reason it was ended was two reasons. Number one, when the parity law was made in 1942, in the law it said, this program will end 2 years at the end of the war, after the end of the war. And what Truman did is he ended World War II on December 31st, 1946. So that meant parity had two more years, 48. And starting at that point, in terms of the farm bills and stuff, the money power, I call them the money power, because they don't like this bill, you see, because people aren't going into debt, right? That's not good, right? So slowly they brought parity down. Instead of, and the parity was written at 90% parity price, and it had to do with the 10% above to make 100 had to do with storage fees. But Randy can talk about that, because I'm not a farmer, I don't understand all of, you know, the storage and whatever. But anyway, so at the end of 1948, parity was 90%. Today, parity is 31%. And that explains why all these family farmers have gone out of business. Tens of thousands of them, because this money power will not allow them to have a decent price to keep our economy decent for everybody. And that they slowly whittled it down, now it's 31%. So that's the basics of, you know, the important things that I see.
Questions?
Yeah,
did you record that, Sue?
What?
Sorry, just wondered if you recorded that, because it was a great speech.
Oh, yeah. Really? Oh, it's still recording.
Well,
I have a question.
Yeah.
Okay, so did the parity program achieve, I know we had a prosperity in the war, which most people attribute to the wartime economy, wartime production and all that. So what is the evidence that the parity actually worked for the economy overall?
During the war?
Well, no, I mean, you know, it makes sense that they would have the parity program during the war, because they needed the farmers to be producing and they didn't want, you know, I mean, I don't know if you are aware of this, but in England, during the war, the farmers, you know, poured their grain onto the street, and the, you know, the workers just basically, right in the middle of the war, would just go on strike, and, you know, yes, our troops are dying over there because you're not making the whatever it is that they need, and the workers would say, you know, we know better than to fall for that, so you're. Anyway, whatever. So, so that's one reason that they would have adopted parity, was because they didn't want trouble from the farmers in the war. But the other question was, you know, the claim is that it makes this fair economy, and you did not give evidence to support that claim, but you did, you know, talk about the farmers going out of business and stuff because they don't have it. But what specific evidence do they have that this produces less debt, etc.? You know, I mean, it's, you say certain things, and I'm just wondering, do you have stuff to back it up? Not that I doubt you, but
yeah. Well, the only, I'm not the best person to answer that, but my answer would be statistically, it was proven in the 30s by these small group of people using the statistics. And you can look at the statistics going forward when the parity price is lowered by the international, traders, the money power, you know. Instead of our government, as part of maintaining the value of our money, making sure our farmers get a parity price, the price is determined by international traders, the money power. And
well, that's today in the commodity markets, right? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, and that's what's...
So the parity replaces the commodity markets for setting prices?
Yes.
Okay, so... All right. And who decides the parity price?
It's decided by the statistics.
So they have a formula based on input costs and things like that?
Yes, and it's a whole national statistical analysis that these men did in the 30s. Because one of them was this very well-known statistician, and he was able to put it all together. But the other men, too, had definite skills. And, you know, they were thinking people, you know?
Okay, so they make the parity prices based on the statistical analysis of what is basically, what is the price the farmer needs, you know, what's the fair price for the farmer, okay?
And that's based on... Well, wait, it's the price that if you give the farmer, that means that the money will flow through the economy into the manufacturers, the distributors, the retailers, and everybody will have a decent treatment in the economy. It's a whole thing for the whole economy.
Eugene Stedman.
Yeah.
Eugene Stack.
Go ahead, Eugene.
You said it would end 2 years after the war ended. The war ended in September 1945. So you have a 5-year period before it ended. Secondly,
Can I correct you? Truman officially ended the war December 31st, 1946.
Because they had to repay
something. I don't know.
Okay. So that's the end of 46, 47, 48.
Yeah.
That's the end of 48 after he gets reelected. So how did it continue until 50, 1950?
That Randy would have to explain.
Okay.
They took it down slowly over the years.
Okay. Okay. I would also like to know, June 1950, the start of the Korean War. So you had something that was similar to the start of World War II, even though somewhat smaller. But you would think that the politicians also would not want disruption of the food chain for supplying U.S. soldiers in the field. So I would like to know, you know, maybe it's a gradual thing, maybe it isn't a sharp cutoff, but I wanted to know, why didn't anyone try to revive it? As they saw, well, it was a very rapid start of the war. So after the war started, did anyone try to revive the parity issue on the basis of wartime hardships? Over.
I don't know about the Korean War, but I do know Wilkin, I think he passed away in 1964, but he was working tirelessly up to that point. And what I was told by the parity farmers, ones that still get together and try to get this information out, is there was a real decision made that parity was going to be slowly taken out, and it was a lot of the farming organizations had people in there that were going to not let parity go on.
What is Wilkins' first name?
Wilkins?
Yes.
What's his name?
It's Charles, isn't it? The same as Charles Walter, or don't they have the same first name?
No, I don't think it's Charles Wilkins. No, it's not Charles Wilkins.
So could you provide a short, and maybe I can find it on Wikipedia, but a short biography, one page or five pages, so that I can read about this individual, please?
Sure.
Thank you.
Great. Definitely. Oh, and you can go to the organization that Wilkins and the other men who did the analysis in the 30s created was a number of years after the war, was changed to the National Organization of Raw Materials. That's a continuation. And you can get it on the internet at NORM, is National Organization of Raw Materials, at NORM. Economics. Let me see if it's, I think it's .org. NormEconomics.org. Yeah.
It's Carl, C-A-R, Carl Wilkin.
There you go.
Thank you.
Oh, and there's the names. If you go to the website and you go to the Hall of Fame, you can see the men who worked with him at that time. Yeah. John Lee Coulter, Charles Ray, and J. Carlson Atkinson. And these are, you know, these were men who used their brains, used their thoughts, used their, you know, ability to think. But they did all of that statistical analysis without a computer.
That's why we have math.
That's why we have what?
Math.
Pencils.
Yeah.
What happened to Mary? I see Joan has his hand up.
Yes.
What happened to Mary? Mary's not here.
That was the name of a movie.
No, but I mean Mary Sanderson.
Anyway, well, somebody allowed Jonah to speak.
Yeah, Jonah, go ahead.
Okay.
Well, did Mary say something? That is she okay?
I don't know.
Well, this, I can understand why the parity concept was discredited, because people who believe in free markets believe that the way you decide the way you decide how many farmers you ought to have is by getting them to produce the right, they produce the food that people need at a price that people can pay. And the farmers who are worst at it wind up not going off to do something else. If we decide ahead of time that whatever it costs the farmers is what they ought to be paid, and there should be as many farmers as want to be farmers, then you need some other method to decide how many farmers you need and how much it ought to cost them to grow their food and so on. See, the beauty of the free enterprise concept is that you don't have to decide any of that. It all decides itself. And it might, in fact, be a good way to do things, except that we don't somehow haven't gotten around to trying it.
Well, yes, Jonah, if you could give me an example of a free market.
Well, no, I can't. But people believed in the concept. And people who believe in that concept are not going to want to decide how much people ought to get paid by how much it ought to cost them to grow to produce their product.
Well, okay.
Yeah, we
and
just
if they
have
can
to
prove statistically that a really free market will treat everybody decently in the society, that would be good.
That would be good, yes.
Kevin Stack.
Mary's back.
Oh, okay. There's Mary. We were worried about you,
yeah,
Mary.
Yeah, Mary.
I had to get away from my power source because we had company, and then boom, the computer said no. But
oh, you had you.
I lost power.
Your laptop. Yeah.
Wow.
Go ahead, Kevin.
They have the the alleged batteries that they have.
Yeah. Those. Yeah, but.
Okay, well, I was just going to say, I think the parity concept is very interesting. And, you know, I've always wondered about it because I have looked at that website, but the website that you're talking about, and I've never really understood it, because the thing that I'm trying to get at is that these prices, okay, so the parity price was set. This is basically like... And they still do this to a certain extent, where you have minimum prices for farm commodities. I mean, I don't know if people are aware of this, because people believe that it's all set in the futures market, and it really is not. Nobody has ever managed an agricultural system on futures markets, but the theory is appealing to certain people, but when you start seeing it in practice, because the futures market, the way that they're structured and the only way they actually work, there are so many people playing in the market who have no economic or practical stake in the outcome. All they're doing is pushing the price around. So it's just, you know, they will talk about, oh, it's raining in Brazil, so the price of soybeans goes down or whatever. The parity is setting the price according to what Sue says. The parity is setting the price according to this criteria that these people have worked out statistically. And I don't mean to say a fair price in any kind of social, agro-socialist way. But what I am trying to say is that they fix the price based on, it's kind of like an economic flow where they figure out how much money, you know, goes here or there. And I mean, I could see where the agricultural sector would do very well if it's done like that. And, you know, the farmers would be doing pretty well. So, but, that's another thing. People get upset about that, too. Believe it or not, the worst thing in the world is if your neighbor suddenly becomes rich.
Well, one thing to keep in mind is that in terms of our economy, 70% of transactions is agricultural.
Oh?
The rest are mining, fishing, those kinds of things.
Right. People totally underestimate that. They think that shopping at the grocery store is the main thing. Consumer buying is, 60 or 70% of the economy, but still.
Well, remember, everybody in our country needs to eat every day. Some eat more, some eat less, but everybody needs to eat.
So if you include grocery shopping in your total of transactions, then we're at 70%.
No, this is the 70% are producers from the earth.
No, it's 70% of the volume of raw material production is agricultural. Volume, like truckloads of stuff that gets produced every year. 70% of the volume of agriculture of raw material production, 70% is agricultural production.
Yeah.
It's not transactions, it's volume of stuff.
So people eat about maybe 80 million tons of food a year.
Yeah, sounds right.
I mean, Americans do. And also we export some. Okay, and then what? Don't we produce a whole lot of coal and oil and stuff too?
Yeah. Anything from the earth is a raw material.
Yeah, I think we might... We use an awful lot of asphalt.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's not a raw material.
Oil and rock.
Yeah.
Oil and rock.
Oil, yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. It's a petrol thing, yeah.
Yeah. It's hard for me to believe that number. It doesn't sound right at all.
Yeah.
Eugene Stack.
Go ahead.
I went to NORM.org, and it's an anti-circumcision website. Now, obviously, it might be .com or something else, but
better. No, it's normeconomics.org.
Oh, okay. Normeconomics.
That's one of those culture jam things. Somebody puts a website like to confuse us on purpose.
Yes, for Carl Wilkins, and maybe I have Wilkins spelled wrong, but he was an Adventist missionary who was involved in the Rwandan genocide, and he was born like
wrong Wilkins,
different guy.
Spell Wilkins for me.
W-I-L-K-E-N-S.
Okay, it's the same spelling, but this other guy.
I'm not sure it has an S. I think it's
no S. Try with no S.
Oh, really?
Okay, all right. Thank you.
If you go to normeconomics.org and go to the Hall of Fame, he's there.
Okay, I'll look there.
Okay. And I don't want to get into it because it's 11, but also part of this to understand is something called a parity tariff. And it goes between exporters and importers, not between one government and another government. But that's a whole other thing, because you don't want cheap imports coming in and undercutting our prices in this country. And that used to be our goal in this country. You know, I think the third law passed by the first Congress of the United States was a tariff law, so that our producers would not be bankrupted, which the United States had, very good at doing.
The United States had very strict tariffs. The United States was never a free trade country until the banking cartel gained power with the Federal Reserve.
Yeah.
Good point.
Well, when the British economy, industrial economy was real strong, and the U.S. economy, industrial stuff was just getting started, we didn't want to depend on the British for that. We didn't want to be their economic colony.
And they very much wanted us to be. So it was a battle that way, a financial battle.
Right, that's what free trade is about. It's a free ride for the financial elements, but it is colonialism if you're not in that group.
That's right.
There you go.
Eugene Stack?
Eugene, go ahead.
So I cannot find the website, because when I go to normeconomics.org, I find the American Economic Association and Kindred. Could you send us a link to the website?
Yes, I will.
Thank you, because I can't find it. Thank
okay.
you.
Sorry. Mary, it's after 11, so.
Well, then we gotta go. Tell everybody. So tonight we didn't get to have our conversation.